Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-5343, Consumers Checkbook Center for the Study of Services versus U.S. Department of Health and Human Services et al. Appellants. Mr. Frank for the appellants. Mr. Baring for the interveners. Ms. Rabner for the appellee.
Good morning.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Steve Frank from the Justice Department on behalf of the Department of Health and Human Services, and I will speak initially for 9 minutes, and I will then leave 4 minutes to Mr. Baring, who will speak primarily on the privacy issues, since he represents the AMA, the privacy prong of the balancing test under Exemption 6, and then I will reserve 2 minutes. Turning first to the injunction, it is very settled law under GTE Sylvania and this court's decision in Morgan that information may not be obtained under FOIA when the agency holding the material has been enjoined from disclosing it by a federal court. The GTE Sylvania court said quite properly that the government should not be in a position of facing contempt by violating an injunction in order to comply with FOIA. And that's the situation that we have here. We have an injunction that essentially bars the release of the kind of data that consumers is seeking here. And in the court below, and I think that this is very critical, we established through a factual showing that by releasing the data that consumers seeks, one could then go and get the amounts of Medicare reimbursements by individually identified providers. And that's the problem with this case. That's the whole problem here, I want to emphasize, is that this case deals with financial information tied to individual doctors. If it wasn't tied to individual doctors, we wouldn't be here. But there's no dispute.
Strictly speaking, the release of this information doesn't violate the injunction. You have to extrapolate. Because the injunction talks about lists of amounts provided, paid, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
None of the information here specifically is the amount that's paid. It's just that you can tie it to other information.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So if that's the case, why isn't it the burden of the government to go to the district court in Florida and ask for a declaratory judgment regarding whether you can release this within the terms of the injunction?
Well, that's to answer
your... Have you done that?
We have not done that, Your Honor, and I think we can discuss whose burden it is, but the principle... A point that we want to make is it's the burden of someone to go to the Florida court and have them interpret their injunction. If it's this court decides it's the burden of the government, then we will do that. If it's the burden of consumers, then they should do that. But the well-established rule is that
you stay the proceedings here. You go off to the Florida court and ask whether this release of this information would violate the injunction, and then get a ruling. And if it says yes, then you've got GTE. And if the other side doesn't agree, they can appeal to the 11th Circuit. And if the Florida court says no, then you proceed here.
Your Honor is 100% correct, and the government would have no objection to that kind of procedure because it follows what the court in GTE Sylvania and the Supreme Court said in Walker, which is that it has to be resolved by the issuing court, and so we wouldn't object to that.
Entangle this whole Florida order if we agree with you on Exemption 6.
That's correct, also, Your Honor. If the court rules on Exemption 6, that deals with the whole issue, and the government also prevails there, and we think we have a very strong case on that. I just like to say that on the injunction, just very briefly, the consumers. Is taking an approach which is form over substance, basically, and their shearing case, which they cited, answers that. That's a case where a veterinarian was precluded from selling drugs in liquid form, and so he tried to sell it in powdered form, and Judge Posner correctly said that's elevating form over substance. So I'd like to, in the interest of time management, move on to Exemption 6, if the court has no further questions on the exemption. As I said, Mr. Berrig will be discussing primarily the privacy interest. We would simply like to state that this court, I mean, I think one might have an initial reaction of saying, well, it's just money, and oh, it's only a portion of their income, and that sort of thing, and denigrate the privacy interest, but that's just contrary to the holdings of this court, including the recent holding of this court in Multi-AG, that, and again, this is the problem, that when you individually identify people and then list their income or a portion of their income, that implicates privacy interests. And again, the problem is that we have this individual identification. If we didn't have that, wouldn't have a problem.
What about the approach that Judge Gazelle took in Public Citizen?
I'm sorry, I did not hear.
What about the approach that Judge Gazelle took in Public Citizen in terms of defining the privacy interest?
I'm sorry, I don't recall that. If you could refresh my recollection, I could.
Well, Judge Gazelle was looking at the fact that these doctors are not required to participate in the Medicare program.
Right.
And that because they are receiving funds, they are performing a quasi-public function.
Right.
And therefore, the privacy interest fades to the extent that Congress has made it very clear that it is concerned about efficient and effective medical services under Medicare.
Yes. I recall at the time distinguishing that case in our opening brief, and so I'd refer the court there. And I think
it's where you say, well, those are old notions of privacy, and you cite these more recent cases, but you know, the more recent cases can be distinguished in terms
right.
of the factual context.
I think that the point there, and maybe the point Your Honor is getting, is that just because this is tied to some kind of a government program, that therefore there's a diminished privacy interest. And the courts have rejected that, painting a drywall, Hopkins. There's a whole series of cases where people are getting construction dollars, and the courts have repeatedly held that you cannot, again, identify those people individually and the amounts of money.
But I thought those courts were focusing, as was Judge Gazelle, not on the fact that the physicians don't have a privacy interest, but balancing that privacy
exactly.
interest.
Your Honor is exactly correct. And I think what Mr. Berrig will establish is that there is a substantial privacy interest here, and the court does have to balance that against the public interest, which is what I would like to turn to now, because I think this is the key to this case, and this is the Achilles heel of consumers. The fact of the matter is there is no public interest to balance against the substantial privacy interest here. There's no, and I mean that in this sense.
Before you go any further, and nobody, I don't think, raised this, but you all didn't, the government didn't appeal the fee waiver decision of Judge.
That's correct.
All right, and in connection with that, he found that the commercial interest was outweighed by the public interest and went into great detail about what the public interest is. I take it you don't feel that because you didn't appeal the fee waiver issue, you're not in any way bound by what he's decided the public interest was.
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, it's entirely two different things, and at that time it was dealing with a whole range of issues and a whole range of data. What we're talking about now is just really one element. I mean, the government's prepared to release all of this information except for the individual identifier number, so it's an entirely different matter. And it's also a question of whether or not the number of procedures a physician has performed will shed light on the agency statutory responsibilities. And I think we made our point quite clearly in our briefs, but I'd just like to stress it, that there is no public interest. The public interest is not just some vague idea of, well, would this be a good idea to let people know how many procedures that their doctors have performed? That may or may not be a good idea, but that's not the FOIA question. The FOIA question is, how is this related to some statutory responsibility of the agency? And there's absolutely nothing that consumers can cite that shows that the agency has any statutory responsibility with regard to the number of procedures that a physician has performed.
No, but don't you think you're taking a somewhat narrow view of the agency's role vis-a-vis the Medicare program? I mean, it's not a question of the agency dictating to a physician you may not perform this procedure, but it's the broader public interest that's suggested here, both in terms of individual citizens as well as referring physicians being able to have this information.
That's 100% correct. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, if I might go ahead and answer Judge Rogers' question. The point I was making is the consumer said that in their brief that if you can show that a doctor has performed a less than optimal number of procedures, that therefore HHS could pay them less money. And that's just not the case. It has no bearing whatsoever on their eligibility to participate in Medicare, as was the case in Multi-AG, and that's how that case is distinguished. It bore on eligibility, and it has nothing to do with whether or not the government would pay. In answer to your question, yes, HHS has responsibility to provide quality care, and it is doing so through a whole series of programs which we outlined in our brief.
But I guess the point would be that just hypothetically, because the agency is performing perfectly, doesn't mean you're not entitled to get FOIA information that is in the
If you can tie it to a statutory responsibility, which they have not, done so. Thank you.
Let me ask you, and we won't take this from your time, but there's a some sort of a handout that CMS gives to Medicare patients. And it has to do with this Medicare's Physician Quality Reporting Initiative. And it came from your website. And one of the questions that it answers for any Medicare patient is, what is the focus of the Physician Quality Reporting Initiative? And the answer is, the PQRI is a first step toward linking Medicare health professionals' payments to quality, which is consistent with Medicare's ongoing transformation from passive payer to active purchaser of high-value health care. What is their mission there? I mean, this language about linking doctors' payments to quality, which is consistent with changing Medicare from passive payer to active purchaser. Do you know what?
Yes, very, very briefly, it's involved, but very briefly, that is one of the steps that HHS is taking to ensure that there is quality control rather than the quantity control that consumers seek. If for a longer answer,
well, how are they tying that to payment?
Okay, that's a private group, and it's peer review, and it's based upon quality. And if this group, which reviews the doctors, if they believe that the procedure was not necessary, was not performed properly, or what have you, they can make a recommendation to HHS, and that does control what the payment would be. So that is a step.
Is the recommendation don't pay this much or don't pay for this procedure or what?
It can limit the amount of payment in a particular procedure. And so the point is, that's an example of what HHS is doing to control quality. And in the interest of time, I would refer the court to page 19 of the amicus brief in support of the government by Attorney Portman, which describes in great detail that program and other programs.
May it please the Court, Jack Bearing for the American Medical Association. I'd like to offer this morning five reasons why the privacy interests of the physicians in this case are great, far greater than those of the farmers in Multi-AG. And in the process, I'd like to address Judge Rogers' question about the physicians. First of all, I think it's a real mistake to say that participation in Medicare is voluntary. Medicare covers all people in this country 65 and older. For many specialties and for many physician groups, physicians have to treat Medicare patients if they're going to pay.
It's not like the draft or anything like that. You're not required to take these people as your patients, and many doctors don't. That's the only point that Judge Gazelle was making.
If you're a gerontologist, a urologist, a number of specialties, you are very likely to have a large majority of your patients be 65 and older. Sure, in theory, you can say you don't have to take Medicare patients, but that really blinks reality. And therefore, for those specialties and those physicians who treat primarily people 65 and older, this publication of their Medicare revenues is, in fact, publication of what is close to their entire income. Second, to further answer Judge Rogers, physicians are not employees or independent contractors of the government like these farmers in multi-AG who are getting subsidies. These are people who are engaged by the patient, are serving the patient, and their responsibility is entirely to the patient. They have a much greater expectation of privacy, I think, than someone who is a government contractor or an employee of the government.
Or a federal judge.
Or a federal judge. That's correct. You are an employee of the United States.
We file financial disclosure reports.
That is correct. Third, there is a substantial privacy interest engendered by the 1979 injunction in the Florida Medical Association case. Physicians have relied for 30 years on the presumption that by participating in Medicare, they are not waiving their privacy interest.
As long as they work in Florida and they're a member of your organization.
Right, and we wish more were members of the American Medical Association.
What percentage do you estimate are licensed physicians in this country?
I think there are, I don't know what the percentage is, I think there are about 250,000.
How many physicians are there?
I don't know, because there's license, there's practicing, but we wish the number were higher, Your Honor, I can say that. But the Supreme Court in the Department of State versus Ray case said that the fact that people have relied on an expectation of privacy is an important factor in dealing with the privacy, in addressing the FOIA issues. Fourth, as Mr. Frank said, it is very easy here to simply convert the information sought by checkbook into revenue information. You just go to the resource-based relative value schedule that Medicare publishes, you get the conversion factor, and you get the information that checkbook wants, and you basically have the revenues of these physicians. And there's a fifth one that this is not in the record, and this reveals the problem that the AMA was not in the case, and this case should be sent back for no reason than to allow the AMA to make the record in this case. But these figures are likely to overstate what physicians, in fact, get from Medicare for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's very common practice for physician assistants who work with physicians to charge under the physician's UPIN number, or it's now called a different name, but basically the number. So the number that will appear will reflect not only what the physician is being paid, but also what the physician assistant is being paid. So that is going to overstate the amount of money that the physician gets. And second, many physicians practice in large groups, and often there's a UPIN number for the group, so it will look like the holder of that number is getting a disproportionate amount of money from Medicare, when in fact that number really reflects the amount that the group as a whole gets, and that it properly understood would have to be divided by the number of people in the group. So we think it will vastly overstate what physicians actually get. My time is up. Thank you very much.
Let me ask you a question. There are two pieces of information, as I understand, consumers' checkbook wants. The number of procedures that Dr. X performed. So it's both Dr. X's UPIN and the number of procedures. If instead HHS released not the UPIN, but just Dr. X, Dr. Y, Dr. Whatever, what would your position be?
You mean they would identify the Dr. X?
They couldn't be identified. No, they couldn't be identified by
anonymous.
UPIN.
If the physicians were anonymized and you couldn't tell what physician, did what, and therefore you couldn't link the revenue figures to a specific physician, we would not have an objection to that.
And how about if they were linked by state only? For instance, Dr. X in the district performed 15 appendectomies.
You'd have to look at the facts of that, Judge Henderson, because that might work for an internist, but for, if you looked at an advanced neurosurgeon who was producing only one, who was performing only one kind of neurosurgery, it might be easily, or at least pretty close to readily to identify that if there's one person in the District of Columbia who performs a certain kind of neurosurgery, then you'd know who that was. So you'd have to look at the facts on that one, which is, you know, another reason why we really need to have a factual record in this case.
And another question I had was this argument about quantity, that is, a number of procedures a particular doctor does. If you're an orthopedic surgeon and you do knee replacements, but you concentrate on young athletes, and you just do, and even though old people need a bunch of knee replacements, you don't do that many, but you're top, you know, you could be top notch because you're treating these young athletes and replacing their knees or doing whatever you do. That would skew, and if the argument is, well, if you've only done 5 knee replacements for Medicare patients, if you're talking about quantity, you're not that good a doctor. That would absolutely not be true in that case.
Your Honor is absolutely correct. There is no way to extrapolate from this information anything about the quality of the physician. And in fact, there have been all sorts of studies which reject the notion that even if you had good information about the number of procedures someone performs, you can go from that to the quality. But as you point out, here you're only seeing the number of procedures that the physician is doing on Medicare patients, and you have no clue as to what that physician is doing on people under 65. So it's particularly misleading. That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Ms. Radner?
Good morning. I'm Nicole Radner on behalf of Consumers Checkbook, Center for the Study of Services. May it please the Court. I'd like to begin by discussing the substantial public interest in disclosure of the raw claims data that Consumers Checkbook seeks. It's important to note that Medicare does not pay every claim automatically. CMS is required by the Social Security Act to ensure that payment is made only for those medical services that are reasonable and necessary under 18 U.S.C. 1395 YA1B. These records will shed light on Medicare's reimbursement operations and allow the public to determine whether HHS is indeed carrying out that statutory mandate. In fact, HHS spends $166 million per year reviewing medical claims. This medical review is intended to identify claims for non-covered or medically unnecessary services. These records will allow the public to scrutinize the program. The public interest here, as I've described, is analogous to that in Multiag, where this court highlighted the fact that the USDA databases at issue were used to establish a farm's eligibility for farm subsidies. Here, the raw claims data are used by HHS to establish whether a claim should be paid. Indeed, now more than ever, the public has an abiding interest to know what they're paying for in the Medicare program, which spends about $60 billion every year on physician services alone. As we've established, the data will shed light on the operation of this extensive program, will allow the public to learn about the quality of physician care performed under it, and will help ferret out fraud, waste, abuse, and inefficiency.
Is it going to enable anybody to understand the quality of care?
How?
Yeah.
Well, for instance, among the raw data that we've requested are the diagnosis and the treatment given. Presumably, and there are treatments that are appropriate and not appropriate for various diagnoses. And this data can be used to analyze what treatment is being given to patients who come in with a certain diagnosis.
What the quality of the treatment was.
Well, that goes to the question of a broader quality of care. Are you getting the appropriate treatment for the diagnosis you have? We've also established, however, that procedure counts.
I can understand if somebody goes in with an earache and the procedure is amputate his leg. I mean that's pretty clear. But that's not what's going on here. What we're talking about is what is the quality of the appendectomy, or what is the quality of the open heart surgery or something. That's what you're talking about. I, for the life of me, I can't understand how you can get any information from this material about that.
Well, studies have shown that with certain procedures, and a physician's experience level matters. And I certainly would want...
It may matter, but it doesn't tell you anything. I mean, the fact that... I mean, that is it's a misnomer in medicine. It's a misnomer in law. If you argue, if you have somebody standing up here that's argued 75 cases, right, that doesn't tell you anything about the quality of their advocacy. There can be somebody else who comes up and argues one case and is far superior to that individual. And it happens in this court, by the way, all the time. So.
Well,
I suspect it happens in medicine as well.
Well, this being my first argument, I'm glad to hear it. but we have shown that in medicine, unlike here in medicine, for certain procedures, experience does matter. In fact, a study that that's in the record below shows that patients can often improve their chances of survival, even at high-volume hospitals, by selecting surgeons who perform those operations frequently. And if a Medicare beneficiary is deciding to have a hip replacement or a valve replacement or what have you, an indicia of that physician's experience level may be whether that physician has the requisite experience to perform it. And the types of analyses that Computers Checkbook can do with the data that we've performed is to show the relative volume of procedures that they've performed. Indeed, the physician identifying information is particularly important because only then can you look at more than just the volume count. If you're deciding between Dr. X and Dr. Y, by knowing their names, other information can be brought to bear, state disciplinary proceedings against that physician, and the like. So there is a link between the quality of care and these types of analyses.
What's that got to do with the operation of government?
As to the operation of government, for example, the Secretary of HHS has discretion to exclude providers from the Medicare program for a variety of reasons. Among those are if the secretary determines that the provider has furnished services to patients substantially in excess of the needs of such patients or of a quality which fails to meet professionally recognized standards of care. That's 42 USC 1320A-7B6. HHS also has the discretion to exclude providers who submit false claims, including claims for a pattern of medical or other items or services that a person knows or should know are not medically necessary. So the disclosure of this data will shed light on the Secretary's own discretion under this statute.
My hypothetical, going back to quantity of
yes.
procedures being tied to quality, the orthopedist who concentrates primarily on athletes and does maybe five for Medicare a year, and yet he's the best one, doesn't that skew that?
Well, it actually points to why the physician identifying information is so important to actually ascertain meaningful quality information, because that's the type of publicly available information that can be gleaned from the public record that the doctor in your hypothetical does in fact primarily focus on sports injuries and the like. Without that information, you would just know you wouldn't be able to bring in other pieces of information that can bear on your decision among providers. I'd like to turn to the privacy interest here briefly to say that.
Can I ask you one thing?
Yeah, sure.
The statute you just cited about making the HHS making sure that the practice of medicine is of a quality that does not fail to meet professionally recognized standards. The way I read this, there's a mandatory exclusion for several things, but for permissive exclusion is license revocation. So that is it true that HHS can still consider a doctor a Medicare recipient if he has lost a license or had it suspended?
Well,
this is under permissive.
That's right, B, not A, exactly. So permissive exclusion, the statute goes on for some pages. The secretary has discretion to exclude providers for a range of reasons. State licensing, I believe, is in that section, as are the items I mentioned. So it's not mandatory, but it's a discretionary exclusion. So under that statute, the secretary has the discretion to exclude or not exclude based on, I think there are like 15 or more reasons that could be.
I guess I just have trouble seeing how serious HHS is in this language about providing a quality that meets professionally recognized standards of health care and at the same time has it within its discretion to keep a Medicare recipient, someone who has lost his medical license by a state board, that it's up to, it's permissive exclusion rather than mandatory.
The requirements for being a Medicare doctor may not fall in that statute. It may be in a step. This is exclusion as opposed to eligibility. So it may be, you may be right that is required. The statute I was referring to is a permissive exclusion.
I think that's in the government's brief.
I think so.
Discussing eligibility.
Exactly. The privacy interest, by contrast, here is minimal. The case that the AMA cited, U.S. v. Ray, is entirely distinguishable on the reliance front. There, FOIA requesters sought the names, addresses, and unredacted interview memos of Haitians who sought political asylum but were sent back to Haiti.
What about the reliance over these almost 30 years? This injunction has been out there.
Well, if you'd like to turn to the injunction, can be no reliance on the injunction because it does not cover raw Medicare claims data. So any reliance argument on...
Well, reliance on the sense that if you're a member of the AMA, HHS is not supposed to release information, at least in the form of a list that tells the public what an individual doctor's reimbursement is. And so the argument is, well, there may be several links to get to that information, but if you can make those links through publicly accessible data, then it falls within the injunction. So a reasonable physician would think, arguably, that's what the argument is, that they've been relying all these years on the grounds that this information will not be publicly available. I just want to know if you think the reliance factor weighs here at all.
I don't. I believe that they're trying to import Fourth Amendment notions of expectation of privacy that are not relevant under FOIA. And the Ray case, as I was about to describe, is wholly distinguishable because there the court found that specific government assurances of confidentiality in the interviews whose memos were going to be released had induced them to cooperate in those interviews. Nothing of the sort is described here. But since you brought up the injunction, Judge Rogers, I'd like to point out that the plain language of this injunction speaks only in terms of a list of annual Medicare reimbursement amounts. A remand, a stay, is not necessary here because this court is competent to divine its plain meaning. Here, the operative document is the final declaratory judgment and permanent injunction.
So you would oppose the suggestion that Judge Randolph explored with counsel for the agency?
We don't think it's necessary here, and it would just further delay this case and put a procedurally complicated and unwarranted new proceeding before the Middle District of Florida. The document...
What's procedurally complicated? And isn't that exactly what we held in Morgan versus Department of Justice is that when they had the Maryland court injunction, that if there was some question about its applicability, that you go to the Maryland court to get it clarified?
Well, in Morgan, you held the government had the burden, if it needed such clarification, to go to that court. The government, which has the burden here to establish that this injunction justifies withholding these records, did not seek clarification. And indeed, we would agree that clarification is not needed. If we look at the document, it speaks in terms of a list. Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 65D requires that injunctions be specific in terms and describe in reasonable detail the act or acts restrained. Indeed, the government confuses the two parts of this document. The injunction portion is contained in paragraph 1. It clearly enjoins only a list. Paragraph 2 of the document is the declaratory judgment, which, as this court explained in Armstrong, the executive office of the president, does not carry the weight of an injunction. We believe this distinction doesn't matter because it also refers back to a list. But in the government's reply brief on pages 7 and 8, it confuses this important distinction and quotes from the declaratory judgment as if it were the injunction.
You would agree, would you not, that the purpose of the Florida court was to prevent disclosure of information that identified the amounts that a particular doctor received from Medicare?
No, the purpose of the Medicare, of the FMA case, it was a reverse FOIA suit to enjoin the disclosure of a particular list of doctors' names and the total amount they received from Medicare. Well, not information concerning their Medicare reimbursement, but a particular list.
The purpose was to prevent the disclosure for the class of material indicating the amount that the doctor received from Medicare, a particular doctor received from Medicare.
A particular HEW proposed to disclose a specific list, and it was that list that was enjoined here.
Why was the list enjoined?
The list was enjoined because disclosure of the list was enjoined because the court there weighed the privacy interests of the doctors against the public interest of understanding what Medicare is paying in light of the ongoing healthcare debate. The court there found that these amounts and these doctors' names are not necessary for that.
The privacy interest that the doctors had in not having revealed the amount they were receiving from Medicare. The court found, right?
Found that outweighed the public interest that he examined, which under Reporters Committee would not be the standard today. But
I agree with you that the wording of the injunction does not specifically cover this information, but the purpose of the injunction clearly does. And in injunction law, for example, if a court issues an injunction preventing a particular contractor from tearing down a house, there'd be no question that if the contractor said, well, it only says tear down the house, and what I'm going to do is take a backhoe and knock out the foundation, that would be a violation of the injunction, even though by its terms it doesn't cover particularly the action. So there is, at a minimum, it seems to me, there's an ambiguity in this injunction.
Well, I'm glad you raised that hypothetical, because this is also how this case is distinguishable from the Shearing case cited by the AMA. In that case, like the hypothetical that you just described, the party that was enjoined then took actions that the court found to be unscrupulous in trying to get around, essentially, what the meaning of the injunction was. Nothing like that has been alleged here. The Consumer's Checkbook was not a party. And there are other policy reasons that, under your hypothetical, it wouldn't be as important to read injunctions so narrowly. Here, this is a nationwide injunction that issued from a single district court over 30 years ago by a judge who's not on the bench, that threatens to thwart the development of the law and thwart disclosure of important information. and the backdrop of FOIA, which is in neither your hypothetical nor in the Shearing case.
The usual way that this comes up, and it happened all the time during the civil rights era, is that there'd be a broad injunction issued, and then somebody would find a way in a school desegregation case to get around it. And then the party that had sought the injunction brings an action for contempt. And rather than holding, because it's ambiguous, rather than holding the individual in contempt or the school board or whatever, then the judge would modify the decree to make it more specific, more specific, more specific. And cases went on like that. And it also happened in the antitrust area, in the Swift case. To draw the parallel here, the AMA should proceed to, it's not the Department of Justice necessarily seeking a declaratory judgment, the AMA should proceed to the Florida District Court for a ruling that if the government releases this information, they should be held in contempt. Maybe that's the way it should go.
And exactly, and we think that that threat rings somewhat hollow here, given that ambiguities in an injunction are read in favor of the party charged with contempt. So we think that HHS need not be worried about being held in contempt in this instance, which when at best there's an ambiguity here, which I don't believe there is, given the importance of narrowly construing this document.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you
very much.
Does Mr. Frank have any time left? All right, why don't you take 2 minutes, Mr. Frank?
This isn't your first argument, is it?
No, and I hope I'm not the 75 guy either. I would like to, in my time remaining, go straight to Judge Henderson's suggestion, which I think goes laser-like to the very heart of this case. As I emphasize, the problem in this case is the fact that it's individually identified physicians. And Judge Henderson suggested, well, how about releasing this data in sort of an encrypted form without identifying the individual doctors? And I think it's a very good suggestion. I think it's one that that HHS would certainly entertain. It would achieve the purported purpose of consumers, allowing them to see about this procedures and whether people are experienced, and at the same time it would preserve the privacy of the individual doctors. Now there may be some costs involved in the agency doing it, but that would solve the problem. The reason why consumers wouldn't be too excited about that, and I know we're not supposed to take into account the purpose, but that's exactly what the district court did and why the district court committed an error of law, because the district court said the consumers needs the individual doctors for their purpose, which is to rate doctors and sell their magazine.
Let me ask you another question. Taking the 1979 injunction on its face, it applies to physicians who practice in Florida and are members of, or any physician who is a member of the American Medical Association. There are, as counsel acknowledged, lots of physicians outside of the state of Florida, he didn't get into that, but who are not members of the AMA. So at least as to that data, why would the injunction have any import?
Well, as we pointed out in our brief, one is that's the way the HHS has interpreted over 30 years, so it creates that expectation of privacy.
Well, that may be the way the agency has interpreted, but has any court upheld that interpretation?
It hasn't been addressed. But the other, which we pointed out, is the difficulty of segregating out members of the AMA from others.
Well, why would that be difficult? I mean, we're into computers these days.
Right. Well, garbage in, garbage out. The computers are only as good as the data. And we would have to rely.
There's been a lot of chatter about that. I mean, FOIA doesn't protect against misleading data from being released as such. So I don't get that argument. And the government's argument, I mean, the first objection to the request here that the government interposed, that it would be burdensome to respond, even as requested, ignoring the 1979 injunction, which wasn't mentioned.
Yes.
So now the government has taken a different position. And so I'm trying to deal with the government's position, namely the 1979 injunction given GTE, bars HHS from releasing anything. And yet there are doctors who don't practice in Florida who are not members of the AMA, and they are not covered under the plain terms of the injunction.
Yes, Your Honor, and I wasn't making an argument of poor HHS, this would be so burdensome on them. The argument went to, we have an injunction. An injunction is sacred. We have to abide by that injunction, and we can't make mistakes.
I understand, counsel, but in fairness, the injunction that the judge issued said this applies to doctors who practice in the state of Florida and to members of the AMA. That was the recertified class in that case. The injunction doesn't speak to these other doctors at all.
I think Judge Randolph had the correct answer there, and he pointed out quite rightfully that in many cases where there's an ongoing injunction, parties have to go back repeatedly to modify it. In fact, we went back and modified this injunction to permit us to release certain information.
Well, I understand, but that covered physicians who practice in Florida and members of the AMA. I'm dealing with this area that the Florida judge never addressed, and I just want to be clear as to what is the government's position as to that set of physicians.
Our position is that there's so much of a chance that, say, the AMA information that they would give to us of who's members and who not members might be inaccurate, that we might violate what is a valid injunction, that we should not be asked to take that chance.
Oh, counsel, wait now. I just need to be clear here. If the department, I don't know what your eligibility regulations say, all right, but if you're supposed to list affiliations on that, then the doctors either state they are members of the AMA or they're not, or HHS could inquire and then accordingly release.
Right, but we'd have to rely upon their membership list, and for example, someone might be a member for a couple of months and then not and drop out. And
well, to the extent somebody's seeking the protection of an injunction, information that would otherwise be required to be released, excluding for a moment our discussion of Exemption 6, I don't think you can sit on your laurels in that situation.
Exactly, and I don't want to beat the injunction to death. We think we have a valid argument there. Your Honor's making the point that it may not cover everything, but Exemption 6 certainly does cover everything, and we think we have an extremely strong case there. If I might.
That's what I was hoping you were going to say.
That's what
you're
it.
Going to say.
It took me a while to get around to that. And I just want to say.
The government is not reading the injunction to cover every physician in the United States, regardless of whether they are a member of the AMA.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I just, in 15 seconds, want to say the government's in sort of a difficult position here. We're caught between an injunction and also we're caught between the Secretary's desire for transparency. We think the Secretary is providing transparency and quality controls, but we have to operate within the confines of the law, which include both the injunction and Exemption 6.
Can I ask you about the, does HHS do anything to inform a doctor who applies to be eligible to receive Medicare reimbursement, any information about whether what he gets from Medicare is a matter of public record? That seems to me to be a question that would be of interest to the physician who's applying.
Yes. I can't really answer that question specifically. I know that that the agency has taken great pains to ensure doctors that information is confidential. There's a whole variety of statutes, which again is pointed out by Mr. Portman. I'd refer the court to that brief, dealing with financial privacy. For 30 years, doctors have relied upon the fact that they're not going to have this kind of information released.
I keep saying that, and I want to know what they're relying on. Is it coming from you, or is it coming from the AMA?
Well, the AMA has spoken to that, and the HHS has taken pains, and if the court would look at some of these programs that are laid out in there, the PQRI and others, that information that the doctors give, especially in that PQRI, it's on page 19 of that brief, that information that they give that's quality information will be held in the strictest of confidence. And to specifically, if I make another 15 seconds to answer the question I didn't entirely, on page 19 of that brief, it does say that these quality organizations can look at it. Ms. Rabner pointed out that the Secretary has a responsibility to make sure that services are reasonably and medically necessary. Those quality organizations can decide not to make any medical payment whatsoever if they feel that it falls below the quality of service, and that's not based simply upon the number of procedures the doctors perform.
Let me just pursue it. Those are private organizations to whom the department has disclosed this information.
That's correct, and but it's peer review, so that's what we think is important. It's peer review.
HHS has interpreted the instruction to allow disclosure for peer review.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
So HHS has construed the injunction to allow disclosure to private parties in connection with peer review.
No, it's not exactly the information that is sought here. It's quality information that the physicians are providing. It's different,
like
different
how many
information.
Times I did this procedure and whether I followed the A method or the B.
I don't believe how many times I did this procedure is part of it.
Well, whether I followed the A method or the B method.
That's right, and what I did and the quality and clinical trials and all of that, it's quality information, and that's what we need. And as Judge Henderson said, we don't want like a doctor who's a conservative doctor in when it comes to prostate cancer and decides to treat people through drugs and radiation instead of surgery to be ranked low on consumer's checkbook rating system just because they take a more conservative approach than a doctor who goes in and decides to do surgery all the time.
Following up on Judge Henderson's point, is it clear to the private individuals who serve on the peer review committees that they are to treat this information as confidential?
Yes. Yes, it is. It's confidential information. I'm sorry I went on, but thank you.
Are you going to ask the AMA guy? Are you going to give any time to the AMA guy?
Oh, all right. Let's see. Do you want to take 2 minutes also? If there are any questions or if you want to respond. I guess I know I have a question, and that is,
honored to answer any questions.
You do inform your members, I take it, of the Florida injunction or the confidentiality of reimbursement amount.
Absolutely, this is a very well-known fact among physicians. And to answer,
what specifically do you tell your members?
It's just widely known that by virtue of the 1979 injunction, the revenues that a physician receives from Medicare will not be publicly disclosed.
But is that an accurate statement of what the 1979 injunction says as to physicians who operate outside the state of Florida?
No, I agree. We're talking about AMA members.
All right.
I agree. And to answer the previous question, to the extent that this information is released to these QIOs, which are not really private organizations, they're operating under contract with the government and acting in a quasi-government capacity, that stuff by statute is required to be held in confidence. The Congress has been exceedingly sensitive to the confidentiality of this kind of information. And when a physician, to answer a question that Judge Henderson asked, when a physician enrolls in Medicare, they are not told, oh, by the way, anything we pay you will be made public, just as private insurance companies don't do that.
But has anybody cited a statute that bars HHS from releasing this information other than the FOIA exemption we've been discussing? You say
well,
Congress
it would be called it'd be the Privacy Act, and physicians are, you know, quite.
I understand, but the way you spoke, it was as though Congress had passed a statute that made this case moot.
No, I didn't mean to suggest that, Your Honor. What I meant to suggest that where there is disclosure to these peer review type organizations, both in terms of these QIOs, both in terms of staff privilege issues under the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act, all of those things are by congressional mandate. Those statutorily mandated peer review, quality review things are explicitly stated to be confidential and not to be disclosed.
So as to all these other physicians who are not your members, despite your advice saying that if you're a member of our organization, you can get confidentiality. They have apparently decided they're willing to have their information disclosed.
I don't think that's what they've decided at all. I think they are relying on Exemption 6. I think that there's an additional layer of protection that comes from being an AMA member. I think if this court were to hold that Exemption 6 didn't apply but the injunction did, I suspect membership in the AMA would increase dramatically. And, you know, from the AMA's point of view, that wouldn't be such a bad result. Have I answered your question?
I did have one other question. That is, all these forms that we fill out every time we go to the doctor's office for patient privacy, and those are statutory mandates, there's nothing in there that protects the physician. Is that correct? Or the physician's privacy.
Your Honor, you're referring to the HIPAA rules,
right.
And HIPAA is addressed toward patient privacy. There's nothing in HIPAA that protects the privacy of the physician. That's correct. That is contained in the Privacy Act, Exemption 6, and the various considerations that underlie the injunction in this case. And by the way, there's also, as you know, an injunction in Louisiana as well in a similar case, which is cited in our briefs. So it's this Florida court is not some aberrational court. A federal judge in Louisiana reached the same exact result on very similar facts. So I think the privacy interest in the physician's revenues has been well established in the law and has not been questioned for 30 years until now. So are there any further questions?
All right. Thank
you very much, Your Honors.
If I may, I have one question for Ms. Rabin. Apart from your magazine, your client's magazine, and only with respect to monitoring the performance of HHS, why would you possibly object to receiving information that doesn't identify the name of the individual physician?
Well, without the physician identifying information, it would be impossible, for example, to perform some of the anti-fraud measures that I described. So the exclusion statute speaks in terms of a pattern of practice of a certain type. And in order to look at a range of information about a physician, either for quality purposes or for anti-fraud purposes, you would need the physician's name to then tie back to disciplinary proceedings, to tie back, as Judge Henderson said, to...
Why wouldn't it be sufficient to, you know, physician 11567? Why wouldn't that be enough for you?
Well, it wouldn't be enough because, obviously, you couldn't look up in other publicly available information like state licensing and so forth. With just that number, you would need the name. For quality purposes, as Judge Henderson pointed out, you also couldn't divine whether the physician who had a low procedure, had a high procedure count, was nonetheless probably not the doctor for you.
Give you I don't know. I have to think, look at this, but maybe it wouldn't give you everything, but it certainly would strike a balance between what you're requesting and the interests of the physicians.
Well, that only assumes that the interest of the physicians here is more than minimal. And given the fact that we're talking about only gross revenue that they receive from Medicare, from the public fisc, the case is really most similar to the Judge Gazelle case that Judge Rogers cited, and the Washington Post v. Department of Agriculture, where cotton subsidies given...
Gross revenue is not a privacy interest?
It's removed from Your Honor's salary,
in
as you mentioned.
The Internal Revenue Service would be totally free to release the tax returns of every individual showing their gross revenue, as long as you don't show what they netted. That is absolutely contrary to many, many laws, not the least of which is all the laws that protect the privacy of individuals through the Internal Revenue Service.
I don't know
where you get that from. Gross revenue is not a privacy interest. Of course it is.
It's It may be some privacy, but it's less private, is our point, than net pay, net wages, and some of the, which was at issue in the cases cited by the AMA.
I have one question, so.
Thank you.
Can I ask just one point, then, since you're here? HHS has now put out this announcement about its new system of transparency.
Right.
What is it that you would not get under that new system other than the individual physician's name?
Well, I believe as, well, first of all, you would get the physician's name under that, which, as we said, is an important fact indicating that the HHS has not been acting as if they think this injunction covers that. But as the government noted, I believe in its brief, there would be confidentiality requirements on that data, so the public couldn't get, you couldn't disseminate that information. We know also from the Alley case that was the subject of our 28J letter, the recent case, that HHS has indeed been giving out this information to private parties, physician identifying information, and only recently to that party stopped doing so. Thank you.